Welcome to the 9th episode of the Activist Files, the Center for Constitutional Rights podcast. I'm Ian Head, and I'm here with my co-host today, Elia Todd.
Hi, Ian.
Hey, Elia. What's going on?
I'm chilling. I'm wearing my layers.
We're getting towards the end of the year. It's a little chilly out. You taking any time off?
Maybe Christmas Eve and maybe the day after. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm getting out of here for like 2 weeks.
That's a beautiful thing. I'm glad you're doing that.
Sometimes you got to take a little break. Are you a celebrator of various religious and pagan holidays?
I come from an interfaith household. Okay. So yes, we have various paraphernalia. So there'll be some celebration. We have on and off years where my sister comes and she's here this year. So I'll actually see her, which is nice.
Nice. I tried to retire from Christmas a couple years ago.
You can't do that.
Because I don't really, I've never been religious and I don't really like the whole materialism stuff. But I pretty much retired. Then I got married to someone from a non-Christian background who has never celebrated Christmas and is very curious about Christmas. I just thought I had closed the door, and now the door is reopening. Not in a cheese ball way, but you know.
I mean, that's not bad, though. I thought you were going to tell me you tried to retire, but that's a no-go because, you know, families don't undo, you know, their rituals. So it's interesting that you managed to retire, and now it's sort of in a reopening in a more educational and learning space. Like, that's nice. That's nice. It could become whatever you want it to become. It doesn't have to be sort of like weighed down with all the materialism and all the negative aspects you'd associated with it.
It's just a tiny Christmas tree with a couple lights on the kitchen table. I'm cool with that.
We have one of those in my house.
All right.
A little one on the bookshelf.
Yeah.
With various things falling off of it. So far, the cat has not knocked it over. Yeah. So, success. And I didn't light anything on fire with the Hanukkah candles. So, we good.
There we go. Well, let's get to this episode. What are we talking about?
On this episode, we're going to hear from a series of organizers about their work and their thoughts about where we are after the last elections.
We asked each of the organizers two separate questions. Here are their reflections in response to those questions.
We're now post-midterms, and I'm sure you've been reflecting on the outcome and what the results mean for organizing in communities. Can you share your reflections for how the results could impact the communities you organize in?
My name is Sharonda Bossier. I am the Deputy Director at Education Leaders of Color. I am based in Los Angeles, but we are a national organization with members representing 30 states. My issue area is education. Despite some disappointments in some key races, many of us are thrilled to see progressive candidates elected to office across the country and continue to hold out hope that this trend will continue through the 2020 elections. However, we remain deeply concerned about the Trump administration's ongoing efforts to roll back the progress we've made under previous presidential administrations with respect to protecting the rights of our most vulnerable students. We're especially concerned, for instance, about attempts to roll back protections for LGBTQI students, especially as the administration has raised questions about its willingness to even acknowledge the existence and humanity of trans people. We remain concerned about the rolling back of borrower protections for higher education students who are targeted and often defrauded by for-profit institutions. We know that many of those students who were targeted are first-generation college students, often from low-income communities and communities of color, which are the communities at the center of most of our work and most of our members' work. And lastly, we are deeply concerned by the Trump administration's attempts to block immigrant families from getting the support of and access to key social safety net programs. Our members serve many children and families, regardless of immigration status, who rely on access to publicly funded healthcare, nutrition, housing programs, et cetera, to survive. And this administration's proposed changes to the public charge rule, we believe, really do put the health, life, and academic prospects for already vulnerable children at greater risk.
My name is Andrea Cologne. I'm the community engagement organizer with the Rockaway Youth Task Force. We're located in Far Rockaway, and we work on educational justice, food justice, criminal justice reform, and civic engagement. Specifically in our district, at statewide positions like didn't really shift much in New York. There weren't any crazy elections based out of Rockaway. But I think overall, one of the biggest wins was Letitia James. Just having a woman of color to be one of the first statewide elected officials is amazing. And another thing, the state Senate being flipped is going to be easier for us to work with in terms of passing legislation. We actually have one piece of legislation in Albany called the Safe and Supportive Schools Act, which would reduce the amount of days that a student could be suspended from 180 days to 20 days and also eliminate suspensions for K-3 students. And the reason why that's so important is because right now a student could get suspended, it's called the superintendent suspension, and it'd be the entire year. If it happens in the middle of the year, it'll carry on to the next year. If it happens on the last day of school, it carries on to the next year. And 20 days is just the equivalent of about a month. And realizing that allowing a student to be out of school for a year is not effective, the chances of them dropping out will be very high, arrested also very high. Just looking at like the alternatives like restorative justice, peer mediation, and how that can be much more effective. And the past few years, it's been getting far in the assembly, but it's never really able to pass in the Senate because it's been majority Republican, but now that's changed. So I think that's one of the biggest part of the results from the elections that will really change our work, being able to pass those bills. Also just like nationwide, seeing the women of color who have been elected to Congress and just like knowing that that's going to spark even more change with folks in communities and possibly even ours to want to run, realizing that our elected officials should represent the demographics of our community.
My name is Brittany Ramos de Barros. I'm Drop the Mic campaign co-director at About Face Veterans Against the War, located in New York City, working on issues of militarism and ending the wars that we're currently in. We primarily organize veterans that are military service members or veterans that have served post 9/11. And so this generation of us is particularly focused on the way that wars have become essentially endless, very quiet, people aren't paying attention to them. You know, the support for or the allowance to continue bombing multiple countries around the world, and then the way that that comes back home, whether it be through military equipment that gets, you know, poured into police departments all over the country, weapons on our streets, as we've seen very recently, troops at the border, and many other ways that it impacts other issues. It's one of the most bipartisan issues. What I mean is that 496 out of 535 Congress members before the midterm were accepting significant contributions from defense contractors, for example, which are corporations that are essentially profiting and being paid tax dollars to manufacture equipment and to participate in these operations in different ways. In this midterm, you know, it was true in the 2016 election, but in this past midterm, there was almost no discussion of military issues, of what candidates' positions were on, for example, Yemen, which is the world's largest humanitarian crisis that we're contributing to. You know, there was very, very little, if any, discussion of that, or the fact that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are not only continue, but in many cases have escalated. We're at, you know, almost the height of the bombing campaigns that we've, you know, the rate of bombing that we've ever been at in Afghanistan, and so forth. You know, I could go on and on. And so we've really shifted, you know, our reflection to thinking about, okay, so there was some maybe progress in terms of getting new candidates that have new progressive perspectives into office, but we know, and we've always known, that that's not going to really get at the systemic change we need to achieve. And what is it going to take for us to build momentum around these issues so that they're at least part of the popular political dialogue and discourse, that at least Congress members don't feel like they can vote however they want or avoid voting on issues like our participation in these wars and not be held accountable?
My name is Jacinta Gonzalez, and I'm an organizer with Mi Gente. You know, and I think as we're reflecting around what's been happening since the midterms or what happened during the midterms, I think for us as Mi Gente, we were really involved in the elections in Georgia. supporting Stacey Abrams for governor with the Hemp Defer Abrams campaign. And what we were able to see and we were able to witness is that with a really exciting platform and with a really exciting candidate, our communities came out to vote in record numbers and came out to vote with such excitement. But we also saw that the system is really rigged in a lot of ways against us. And we saw the extent to which our opponents are willing to go to make sure that people are not able to vote, to make sure that votes aren't counted, to make sure that in any way, shape, or form, they're able to preserve their power. And so I think it just reminds us of, one, how we have to continue to build electoral power, but also, two, how we have to continue to be organizing our communities to be able to confront these systems that are hell-bent against making sure that we aren't able to access what our communities deserve, which is just a dignified life, access to healthcare, access to education, and protection from the deportation and criminal justice system.
My name is Reginald Harris, Color of Change, Deputy Field Director for Nevada, California, and Texas. Color of Change focuses on issues that impact Black people. I'm thinking about the results of voting rights in states like Nevada, where we had question number 5 that restores or this automatic voter registration, meaning when you turn 18 and you're an eligible voter, you go to the Department of Motor Vehicles and you're automatically enrolled to vote. Voter suppression is cut down because question number 5 was passed in Nevada. I'm thinking about the passage of Amendment 4 in Florida, which to me is monumental. Basically, what Amendment 4 did was restore voting rights to 1.4 million people formerly felons, and 500,000 of those people are Black. Now there's going to be no way for politicians to outright and blatantly ignore Black people at the polls without paying the price.
My name is Stanley Fritz. I am the New York City Campaigns Manager at Citizen Action of New York. We are a multi-issue grassroots organization, but we're currently focusing on democracy and fair elections, criminal justice reform, and education as our 3 top line issues. We're a statewide organization. I run the New York City chapter. This election was huge because it really was community and grassroots power that got us the Democratic majority that we have. And I think a combination of what happened in the primaries with Governor Cuomo being challenged and what happened in the general election with Republicans being challenged and defeated by Democrats, we have a real opportunity to see some real transformative policy at the state level this year. And that includes bail reform, maybe even legalization of marijuana, some housing laws that benefit tenants and not so much landlords. And the ones that I'm the most excited about is comprehensive campaign finance reform. When you're talking about politics and policy at the state level, at least for us at Citizen Action, we're not trying to pass things or put things through that are just going to be a Band-Aid. We're looking for things that will shift the conversation and transfer power. If we can get comprehensive bail reform through in New York State and cash bail for nonviolent offenses and for these crimes at the state level, you're talking about potentially releasing up to 40% of the population of people sitting in Rikers Island right now who have been charged of nothing and are only sitting in these jails because they cannot afford their bail. If you go upstate, you're talking about even larger numbers of people who would no longer be sitting in jails because they cannot afford to come out. That shifts the power structure in the criminal justice system, and it allows people the opportunity to live and build their lives without having it thrown apart by a system that has been inherently racist. If we can legalize marijuana, and on top of that, we can exonerate and clear the records of the millions of Black and brown people who have been charged with marijuana offenses in the last 50 to 60 years, that is a dramatic shift in power. People all of a sudden have a new lease on life. Their records are clear, and they can engage in the industry that they have been criminalized for so long. We have a chance to legalize marijuana in New York State in a way that no other state has done, and that means not emphasizing the big corporations, but making it possible so that the people who have gone to jail, have been harassed by the cops, who have gotten fines or spent the weekend in bookings can be the ones that benefit from it, all while bringing in extra revenue to the state to fund education and other pieces.
Thinking about the political climate that we've been battling the last 2 years, What's next for you and the communities you organize in? What's the priority?
Sharonda Bossier. Our members are maintaining their commitment to working on behalf of our country's most affected and marginalized communities. Given the Trump administration's demonstrated hostility to low-income communities, immigrant communities, and communities of color, our members have doubled down on their work to ensure that their school communities remain welcoming places for children and families, regardless of immigration status, income, gender identity, or sexual orientation. So that means that we are focused specifically over the next year on two things. One is building a coalition of organizations in partnership with organizations like the Education Trust, the National Black Justice Coalition, and GLSEN to learn more about how we can protect and build school communities that are supportive of LGBTQI students of color. We launched a listening tour a few weeks ago and are already learning so much about how to better support LGBTQI students. We're listening to the experts, in this case, the students themselves, as we identify our policy proposals and priorities. And so we'll have something to share in the coming months. Two, we are fighting the proposed changes to the public charge regulation. We find the proposed changes deeply concerning and are lending our voices and resources to resisting those changes in a couple ways. The first is submitting public comment and speaking out in opposition to the changes. And the second is educating our members on the community eligibility provision and other ways they can ensure that the young people in their care are able to have access to basic supports and to have their needs met while working to ensure that individual families are not targeted and are not discouraged from seeking out the resources and support they need. Our members in the communities they serve face a number of battles on many fronts. Our goal as EdLock is to continue to provide the support and resources to ensure our members are able to do their best work and that the children and families they serve are given access to every resource and opportunity they need to thrive. Our goal is not to just increase student academic outcomes. It is to disrupt cycles of generational poverty, to help families build wealth, and to change the faith and values of leadership in our country. We know that to do that, we have to go beyond education. We have to organize and mobilize our members in support of efforts to shore up our country's safety net and ensure we all live up to our values as Americans, that we welcome in the tired, cold, and hungry stranger, that we stick up for and protect the besieged. Our members, educators who serve millions of children each day, are committed to doing that and to doing whatever it takes to ensure that no child is denied their fair shot at the life they dream for themselves because of where they were born, how much money their family earns, or how they identify or who they love.
Andrea Cologne, the Safe and Supportive Schools Act. So we have to start there when it comes to our city work. There's only so much we can do on the city level in terms of advocating for legislation if the state does not allow for those sort of changes. So I think the Safe and Supportive Schools Act is definitely one of the biggest things that we're going to be organizing around come January. Another thing that's a priority for us is ending arrest and summons in New York City schools. So it would end arrest, summons, and juvenile reports for all misdemeanors and low-level violations. Usually every quarter, every year, it tends to go up, the amount of arrest and summons given. But something that's been very clear is the racial disparities. For example, one year it was 63%, Black and Latinx students only make up 63% of the school population, but make up around 98% of the students arrested and given summons. So we clearly see that there's a disparity there, and realizing that it's not just about educational justice, it also comes down to racial justice and creating a safe, nurturing, supportive environment for students of color. It's definitely something we're going to be organizing around. And I think just also having conversations now that the political climate has changed in Washington after what we've been battling the last 2 years around the possibility of some federal legislation. It still would be hard, but I think just having conversations to see how feasible it is, what can be done, who we have support from, I think that's going to be a conversation also coming up around what we'll be organizing. But yeah, those are really the biggest things around education, just really making sure that students of color are given the resources and the environment to be able to succeed and feel safe in schools and not feel like they're being over-policed or like they're not getting the resources that they need. Really just about prioritizing the youth voice.
Brittany Ramos de Barros. I think what we're seeing in this moment
is unprecedented intersectional movement momentum. There's stats out there that say 1 in 5 people living in the United States have participated in a protest in the last year, for example. That's levels that are unprecedented as far as anyone can tell from data that existed in the history since the formation of the country. So that's really exciting. And I think what we're also seeing is that those movements are interconnected, both in terms of the various leaders of those movements' relationship to each other, popular understanding of the way that those issues connect to each other across race, class, gender, and so forth. I feel, in kind of my analysis, is that there's real opportunity and need for kind of that independent movement momentum around issues of militarism and holding that anti-militarism lens in the midst of that work. And so About Face has been doing work for years, building relationships across movements. And right now we feel like with everything that's happening, you know, including political changes and current events, like the growing attention to what's going on in Yemen and even, you know, renewed statistics being published about increasing of death and destruction and our bombing in Afghanistan and all of these other things, as well as the very visible nature of the way that the military is being leveraged in places like everything from Standing Rock to the border now, that there's a growing awareness of the interconnection between this issue. And we feel like there's a real opportunity for us, along with other impacted, you know, very directly impacted communities, to band together and really build out that movement momentum. And so I think some of the early focal points will inevitably be, I mean, in this literal moment right now, talking, you know, feeling an urgent obligation to have a powerful voice speaking out against the military presence at the border and the way that that is playing out, and the way that that plays out even with federal agencies that are militarized outside of the literal military. But then also talking about the connection between that and between these ongoing wars overseas, and even the fact that our tendency to deprioritize those is rooted in the same white supremacy and devaluing of Black and brown bodies that allows for Black and brown people to be abused, attacked here on our streets, as we see arise in, you know, various different kinds of violence and hate crimes and state violence and so forth. And so for us, that's a big piece. There is a Yemen War Powers Resolution that has just been untabled in the Senate that I think is a real opportunity. Obviously, because what's happening, our contribution to what's happening in Yemen is really important as a standalone issue that we need to stand against and that we need to end, but also because this will be the first time that Congress formally debates war powers and the limitations of war powers since the 2002 authorization for use of military force that authorized the invasion of Iraq. And so those documents, the 2001 authorization for the invasion of Afghanistan, and then the 2002-2003 authorization and subsequent Iraq invasion, those two documents are the same documents that are being used to authorize all of the very different, diverse, and connected military operations and bombing campaigns that we have happening in 7+ countries right now. We're really hopeful that this bill, for example, is not going to solve everything, but it is a really solid step in the right direction. You know, whether or not it passes, obviously, if it passes, it's starting to set precedent again of putting guardrails on executive ability to use the military however it wants, which has had a blank check and a, you know, kind of unbounded authority, essentially, to be allowed to do that by the Congress for the last 15+ years at a minimum in modern time, but also to revive popular public discussion about the fact that that has been unbounded, to push that into electoral discourse that could impact the 2020 election and make politicians really feel accountable, but then also continue to spark conversation about why these things are happening and how deeply connected our poverty issues that we're talking about with corporations and you know, understanding the way that profit motivation is driving basically war for profit, and why, you know, and how that's deeply connected to structural changes that need to happen in our electoral system. The summary is that we really feel like it's been tough to get folks to pay attention to these issues in any capacities for over a decade, and a lot of anti-war vets and folks have felt really beat down by how difficult it is to get people to pay attention, but that we're in a new political moment, that there is a real opportunity for momentum, and that there's the groundwork that has been laid with building relationships across movements to really like do this in a way that is intersectional and contributes and centers marginalized voices alongside other movements that are having really revolutionary changes, even if only in changing the way that people think right now.
Jacinta Gonzalez, during the last 2 years of the Trump administration, we've really started to see how both he's been revving up his deportation and policing machinery. We've seen it through policies that are coming from the Department of Justice. We've seen it through practices coming out of the Department of Homeland Security. And I think we're starting to see how they're being able to do worse and worse things. I mean, we saw it over the summer with the separation of families at the border. We're seeing it now with the military at the border yet again, confronting people that are simply coming here to look for basic protection. And I think we're looking forward to another 2 years of very similar politics. And we have to be able to both do two things at the same time. We're always being asked to stretch ourselves in many ways because we're both asked to protect the communities that are most directly targeted by this violence, but also figure out how to push forward a proactive and positive agenda that really people can believe in and can fight for. And so we see us having to do this both in our communities and in the electoral agenda to be able to both say, stand against the prosecution of migrants at the border. And we believe that these laws can actually be reversed. And we believe that we can be a community that can stand for different ideals. And so I think we're trying to be able to balance both things. I think in the coming 2 years, we're really thinking about how to build up political power, how to be able to combat the policies that are coming from this administration and promote an alternate agenda, but also take on corporations and other actors that are supporting them. And so that's why for us, it's been so important to be focusing on the No Tech for ICE campaign, exposing the data and tech companies in Silicon Valley that are really supporting Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that are supporting this administration in expanding its policing capabilities, its surveillance capabilities. And so for us, it's going to be important to both be able to figure out how do we build political power to change who's in government, but also think about how private actors are also affecting our communities and how we can hold them accountable to a human rights standard.
Reginald Harris. For us in Nevada, we won 5 of the major races that we were involved in. We won a black attorney general. We won a 1 of 2 Senate seats, I believe, that we won this year, who was, by the way, a woman. We a Democrat governor. And so with all these wins that we have and that our membership was involved in, we now are focused on making sure that our membership is mobilized from a ground level, bottom up level, hearing what matters to them and what affects our communities most deeply, and then mobilizing and organizing them to hold these politicians accountable. If that means creating a list of demands that they want to see enacted within the first 100 days or what have you. But I mean, the first thing is to sit down with our membership, figure out exactly what matters to them most, and then we implement a strategy of accountability to the people who we enable to enjoy our votes and put them in office.
Stanley Fritz, I think our number one priority is to get a robust democracy package passed as soon as possible. And what that means is early voting, automatic voter registration, make it so that you can change your party a lot easier in the state, but then also comprehensive campaign finance reform with publicly financed elections. In the city council where we have publicly financed elections, you have seen a new crop of people of color, of women, of folks in the LGBTQIA community who have been able to run for office and win because they're going through a public matching system that the city is supporting, which means they don't have to go after the real estate developers. They don't have to go after the lobbyists. They don't have to go after big money people. They can raise money from the communities and win. And if we can get that passed at the state level, so now you see assembly members, state senators, the governor, the state attorney general, and even district attorneys can run from publicly financed funds. It was the same thing at the state level that has already happened at the city level, where you'll be seeing dynamic women, black people, more Latin people, more people from the transgender community, all of a sudden having the power to take on leadership at their state. And if you do that, and you get it early, it makes it easier to win fights on housing, which has been just taken over by the real estate lobbyists who pump money into candidates and elected officials to try to get them to vote on policies that hurt tenants.
Here's a roundup of some of the headlines here at the Center for Constitutional Rights. A Salvadoran mother and her 4-year-old son are together again, 8 months after U.S. immigration agents separated them at the border, and 4 months after the Trump administration wrongly deemed them ineligible to reunite. A federal judge ordered the Department of Homeland Security to reunite the mother, referred to as Ms. Q in the case, and her son, Jay. They were reunited in Texas, hours before the deadline, and released from DHS custody soon after. Ms. Q said her son did a double take and then ran right up to her and gave her lots of kisses. To date, federal courts have rejected the Trump administration's vicious family separation policy.
Meanwhile, a federal court temporarily blocked the Trump administration's new asylum ban while we worked to get a preliminary injunction. The Center for Constitutional Rights, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Southern Poverty Law Center brought the case on behalf of East Bay Sanctuary Covenant, Al Otro Lado, Innovation Law Lab, and the Central American Resource Center in Los Angeles. The courts were clear: Trump cannot simply obliterate decades-old U.S. and international law, ensuring a right to safe haven from persecution and violence.
Center for Constitutional Rights senior staff attorney Katie Gallagher, the legal representative for 2 victims in the International Criminal Court situation in Afghanistan, informed the ICC of serious concerns about the physical and mental health of one of the victims, Shekawi Al-Haj, and the lack of adequate response to his situation by the United States. We continue to urge the pretrial chamber to grant the prosecutor's request from over a year ago to open a formal investigation into crimes in and related to the armed conflict in Afghanistan.
The Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal sent 3 letters last week challenging efforts to suppress advocacy in support of Palestinian rights, including a letter expressing concern over threats to investigate Professor Mark Lamont Hill. Professor Hill was fired by CNN after giving remarks at the United Nations expressing support for Palestinian rights, and has also been threatened with investigation by Temple University, where he is a tenured professor. We also joined 10 other civil rights groups in sending a letter to the Department of Education's Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, Kenneth Marcus, to demand he end his department's attacks on student free speech. Prior to his appointment by Trump, Marcus, a leading apologist for Israel, openly urged filing complaints with the DOE to chill speech critical of Israel and brought suit against the American Studies Association for endorsing a boycott of Israeli academic institutions. The third letter renewed our opposition to the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, unconstitutional legislation that members of Congress are now attempting to attach to a year-end spending bill.
After a 3-day trial, a Louisiana judge found that the Bayou Bridge Pipeline Company trespassed on privately owned land when it constructed its oil pipeline in the fragile Atchafalaya Basin, but unfortunately allowed the company to exercise eminent domain over the property. Landowners with 38 acres of property interests in the basin, represented by Center for Constitutional Rights and Atchafalaya Basin Keeper, challenged the land grab and damage to the property resulting from the construction of the pipeline without their permission. The judge in the case awarded each of the landowners the paltry sum of $150. Senior staff attorney Pam Spees said the pipeline company made a calculated business decision that it was cheaper to violate the law than to follow it. And while the court did find the company trespassed on our client's land, the damages award validates their business decision. We plan to appeal.
And finally, we worked with organizations, including the Vermont-based Migrant Justice, to file a lawsuit in federal court alleging ICE and the Department of Homeland Security, with the assistance of the Vermont Department of Motor Vehicles, conducted an unlawful multi-year operation to surveil, harass, arrest, and detain Migrant Justice's members and leaders in retaliation for their First Amendment-protected speech and assembly, and in order to destabilize Migrant Justice and its successful organizing of Vermont's immigrant farm workers. Federal immigration authorities had infiltrated the group's meetings through the use of a civilian informant. These efforts form part of a larger pattern of suppressing immigration activism nationwide.
Remember to subscribe to the Activist Files podcast on iTunes or check us out on Spotify or SoundCloud. And now for the real AF.
The Real AF.
Yeah, I just need you to say The Real AF.
The Real AF.
Welcome to The Real AF. This is Ian. I'm here with Leah Todd. And our guest today is Bahar Azmi. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good. All right. Let's go. Let's get to the questions. Would you rather have all of your music on cassette tape or CD?
CD, considering that the only vessel I have to play a cassette tape left is a vintage Sony Walkman.
That's classic, though. That's well, great that you have that.
It is. Yeah. And headphones with the sort of soft felt pads. Yeah.
What inspired you to keep your Walkman all this time?
Because I have a couple of mixtapes from college, high school.
The days of mixtapes.
Yeah. Amazing. Some more special than others. Mm-hmm. Some maybe gifted to me for special sentimental reasons that I imagine I'm going to listen to. Mm-hmm. Maybe on my deathbed.
Would you rather play frisbee golf or croquet?
I'm going to have to say frisbee golf, as offended as I am by that concept generally, only because I've heard the word, I don't really know what croquet is.
You ever seen the movie Heathers? They play croquet in it.
Oh.
Yeah, now you know what it is, yeah.
Is that it, with mallets and balls and little things like that? That actually seems a little bit more fun and probably can be played, unlike frisbee golf, with a gin and tonic in hand. So I might switch my vote if it's not too late.
Yeah. Would you rather hang out with Batman or Captain America?
I don't have much of a sort of dog in the fight. Isn't Captain America just super positive and annoying? I guess I'd go with Batman. He's kind of dark, right?
Too happy for Captain America.
Batman's dark. I'd like to spend time.
Yeah.
I'd rather spend time with him. I can't stand sunniness in a superhero.
Would you rather have a bit role in Casablanca or The Godfather?
A bit role in either?
Yeah.
Oh, The Godfather, no question about it. Maybe it's like a, like how bit, like as a what, like in The Wedding Band, maybe.
Yeah.
That small or something?
Sure, whatever, you, maybe one or two lines.
Oh, that would be amazing. I'd like to be in the wedding scene, maybe on the dance floor, serving some punch, perhaps.
I like it.
Spin around the dance floor.
I like it.
I wouldn't want to be one-on-one with Don Corleone. I don't think I can pull it off.
Would you rather spend a week at Burning Man or a month alone at a writing retreat?
Ooh, like how alone? Like alone?
Alone. I know there are some writing retreats where you aren't allowed to like talk to anyone, use the internet at all. Keep pushing towards that level of alone.
I think that's I like a little darkness. I think that's a little too dark for me.
So Burning Man.
Yeah, Burning Man. We'll play croquet.
Thank
that
you, sir.
That was fun.
Yeah, this is fun.
That was fun.
You're really good at this.